These voices made headlines this week.
Our people who've been in the business for 30 and 40 years have never seen anything like it.
We have this day assumed our sovereign independence.
General Eisenhower has had a definite heart attack.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, the sounds of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Fred Foy with Voices in the Headlines. The sounds of a great city. They might be the sounds of Boston or Albany or Hartford or Toronto or New York. New York, Baghdad on the Hudson. A sprawling, bustling, vibrant, electric city. Its lights turned on as dusk and then night came on Tuesday. Gaudy Times Square was a glittering great white way. It was 5:28 p.m. A sudden stillness. Lights flickered, wavered, trembled, and went out. Train stopped. Traffic lights no longer winked their silent commands. Subways stopped in black tunnels. Stalled elevators dangled in the concrete and steel throats of buildings, scraping a sky in which the stars could be seen, and a full moon, too, as the city groped in the dark. New York City was not alone. New York State, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Boston, part of Canada, all caught by the unbelievable, all left idle and darkened by the most gigantic power failure in history. 30 million people, over 80,000 square miles of northeastern United States and Canada, began a 12-hour ordeal of darkness. The reassuring voice of the federal government, White House News Secretary Bill Moyers, who spoke for the president.
This failure should be immediately and carefully investigated in order to prevent a recurrence. You are therefore directed to launch a thorough study of the causes of this failure.
Whatever the cause, the effects were plain enough. This from ABC newsman Joe Morgan in Toronto.
The blackout created chaos and confusion for more than 2 million persons here in the metropolitan Toronto area. This was the worst power failure ever to hit a major Canadian city, but could prove to be an education in the event of any future national emergency. Joe Morgan, ABC, Toronto.
With New York City's power off, the heart of the nation's communication system was silenced for an instant. Then, with the initial moment of shocked surprise over, the heartbeat was heard again. ABC Radio in New York was connected by special lines to Chicago and Washington. And from there, the story of the week, and possibly of the year, was flowing over the ABC radio network from a candlelit newsroom in New York to ABC in Chicago and Washington, and then to the rest of the country. There was a report from United Nations correspondent John McVain, who had a special and spectacular view of the blackout. McVain reported,
I was in midair, flying from Boston to LaGuardia Field, New York, when the pilot said, ladies and gentlemen, something has happened which I have never seen before. There are no lights in the whole of Manhattan Island. What had happened? Were we going on into outer limits or on a twilight zone trip? To see the lights all out over Manhattan was a shock. John McVain, ABC, Newark, New Jersey.
But it was with the ordinary man and woman where the story of the blackout was found. A woman in New York, a subway rider, suddenly trapped below the streets of her city.
I was down about two levels, but with the aid of matches, we all got out.
No panic.
And the people were rather pleasant.
The city, with a reputation for being cold and cynical and which allegedly couldn't care less about a single individual's problems, showed its heart, its courage, and even the ability to have fun in the midst of its troubles. Jim Harriet found a teenager directing traffic.
Hold it!
What are you doing in the middle of the street?
Excuse me. Go ahead.
I'm trying to control the traffic.
Did someone appoint you to do this?
No.
Just did it on your own?
Yes.
You having any trouble with directing traffic?
No.
Do the motorists seem to pay attention to you?
Yes.
How old are you?
Yeah, I'm 17. Hey, these cars go right past, see? All right!
How long have you been out here? About a half an hour? You getting tired?
Me, no. It's fun.
But the time for fun ended, and there was that big question. Why? How did it happen? How could it happen? That question remains unanswered. New York's Consolidated Edison Electric Company is Charles Hoppen.
Electric companies are interconnected by electric lines. These are there for a variety of reasons, emergency backup, economy, sales of power. This was a situation that certainly has been unique to our company. Our people who've been in the business for 30 and 40 years have never seen anything like it.
New York's mayor-elect John Lindsay told ABC,
"It seems incredible to me that our lives hang on a thread. That is to say that the entire Northeast should be hung up on one power line."
Mayor Robert Wagner said,
"I want to again express my appreciation to the citizens of New York City and those who are visiting New York for the way they've handled themselves in this very serious emergency."
And Governor Rockefeller,
"Maybe it will turn out to have been a blessing in disguise, because we will learn the steps that we've got to take in a whole range of areas to prevent this happening again, and that we are better protected."
Slowly, finally, after 12 hours, the lights were back on. The investigations were begun. The ordeal was over. How did that cynical New Yorker feel?
Oh, it's like the greatest thing in the world to have it all back again.
On Thursday, an event that most of the world hoped to prevent happened. On short wave from Salisbury, Rhodesia, Prime Minister Ian Smith made an announcement.
"We have struck a blow for the preservation of justice, civilization, and Christianity. And in the spirit of this belief, we have this day assumed our sovereign independence."
The white government of Rhodesia broke with Great Britain after a last-minute flurry of diplomatic attempts to stop the independence declaration, the first unilateral break with the British crown since the 13 American colonies did it in 1776. Rhodesia's Ian Smith said,
"In the lives of most nations, there comes a moment when a stand has to be made for principle, whatever the consequences. This moment has come to Rhodesia."
Smith's announcement came after more than 2 years of negotiations, in which Britain refused to grant independence unless Rhodesia's 4 million Negroes had a majority voice in the government. When the break came, Prime Minister Harold Wilson said,
"This is an act of revolt against the Crown, against the Queen. We have announced a whole very wide, sweeping range of economic measures."
And a word to the British from U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk.
"The President instructed me to inform Prime Minister Harold Wilson that the United States government in no way recognizes the rebel regime."
The United States invoked diplomatic and economic sanctions against the Rhodesian rebel government. United Nations Ambassador Arthur Goldberg pledged,
"The United States government will not recognize any regime in southern Rhodesia which purports to emerge from this illegal unilateral declaration of independence."
Ambassador Goldberg spoke at the UN to the rebels in Rhodesia.
"We must reaffirm to them here today that there are others in the world community who are more unyielding and more determined, unyielding in their conviction that self-determination must apply to all the people of southern Rhodesia."
Also in the UN, British Foreign Secretary Michael Stewart.
"The British government is resolved that an attempt to impose a constitutional solution by military force in Rhodesia would not only involve misery for millions of innocent people, but would thrust into a still more distant future the right and just solution to this problem."
African nations in the UN urged a Security Council resolution to condemn the independence declaration. The resolution came to a vote on Friday.
"The result of the voting is as follows: 10 votes in favor, none opposed, with one abstention. Accordingly, the draft resolution has been adopted."
After that resolution condemning the white Rhodesians, the African nations urged the British to lead a military attack to put down the revolt. They made somber predictions of a bloodbath. In London, ABC's Charles P. Arnold questioned a Negro Rhodesian.
You say the African people in Rhodesia, the 4 million, the bulk of them are ready, as they say, to fight to the last drop of blood for their independence?
Yes. I'm quite confident that they are prepared to fight.
On Monday, former President Dwight Eisenhower played 18 holes of golf at Augusta, Georgia. At midnight, he felt chest pains. At 2 in the morning on Tuesday, he was taken to the hospital at Fort Gordon, Georgia. Later in the day, his physician, Dr. Thomas Mattingly, reported.
President Eisenhower experienced a short episode of chest pain this morning, about 30 minutes after midnight. Now, in view of his heart history, any recurring episode of chest discomfort must be carefully evaluated until it is adequately explained.
Captain Wallace Hitchcock at the Army Hospital told ABC,
I can confirm that the general is in the hospital. Mrs. Eisenhower is with him. He's undergoing tests, and he's feeling no pain, resting comfortably.
The former president was placed in an oxygen tent. And later reports on Tuesday were encouraging. But on Wednesday, there were new chest pains. On Friday, Captain Hitchcock confirmed what Americans feared.
Further electrocardiograms and blood studies since the second episode of chest pain have revealed that General Eisenhower has had a definite heart attack.
General Eisenhower's heart attack was said to be milder than the one suffered 10 years ago when Eisenhower was president. But a concerned nation and world paid close attention to continuing medical bulletins from Georgia. In the air over the Ohio Valley, an American Airlines plane from New York's Kennedy Airport was over Kentucky and preparing for a landing at the Cincinnati, Ohio Airport. Then disaster, as the Boeing 727 jetliner crashed, killing 58 persons. A police spokesman in Florence, Kentucky, near the scene of the crash, told ABC,
the report we have is that it's an American Airlines commercial plane. And there are some survivors. We have 2 men there. But we don't have any report of the dead or the survivors.
United Airlines Flight 227 of today, with 83 passengers aboard and a crew of 6, suffered an accident on landing in Salt Lake City. There was a fire shortly after the start of the landing roll. The incident occurred at 5:55 Mountain Standard Time. This aircraft originated this particular trip at LaGuardia Airport in New York City, with stops in Cleveland, Midway Airport in Chicago, Denver, and Salt Lake City. The flight was scheduled to continue through to San Francisco.
The voice of Doug Timberlake of United Airlines in Chicago. The grim confirmation of a second plane crash, also a Boeing 727 jetliner, and the third 727 accident in 2.5 months. The United plane crashed at Salt Lake City 3 days after the American Airlines crash. 50 survivors out of 91. Neil Linton of ABC affiliate KALL in Salt Lake City was one of the first on the scene of the Thursday plane crash.
The entire top half is burned away. There is the one entire propeller unit about 50 yards away from the airplane. The plane landed from the south and is now facing north off the runway.
Federal officials indicated that they believed 727 class planes are safe, and that the causes of the crashes would be known only after months of investigating. But the two plane disasters were soon overshadowed. Fire at sea. A passenger ship ablaze in the night. The Yarmouth Castle, a cruise ship out of Miami heading for the Bahamas. 549 people on board, a burning ship. A survivor told what it was like on board.
I heard someone yelling.
people were saying that, screaming for help. And I looked out through the porthole, and I could see the smoke up on the upper deck coming through.
As passengers and crew abandoned the Yarmouth Castle, other ships and Coast Guard helicopters began rescue operations. One of the copter pilots, Lieutenant Commander Bernie Hoylan, told ABC,
"We picked up the three people left the scene. It was still dark and the ship was burning like crazy, but we didn't see it go down. We offloaded the people, picked up some fuel, and came on back to the scene. And when we got back there, it was just a big slick where she'd been."
The Yarmouth Castle sank, apparently without sending out distress signals. Nassau Police Chief Nigel Morris reported on rescue operations.
The Bahamas Star, which is another cruise ship, and a Finnish ship called the Finn Pope, has transferred most of the passengers from the Yarmouth Castle onto their ships. They're now heading for Nassau and should arrive here about 2 p.m. this afternoon.
Of the Yarmouth Castle's 549 passengers and crew, 90 listed as missing and presumed dead. One died in a hospital. 458 survivors. Other voices this week spoke of a battle between an industry and government, of Red China, an election in Canada, and Cuban exiles. The exiles among the last to leave Cuba by ship. Next month, an airlift will replace the sea lift taking anti-Castro Cubans from Cuba. As one of the last sea voyages began, State Department spokesman Robert McCloskey said,
"The first is to leave at midnight tonight. It will accommodate probably 100 to 110 refugees, and we expect it to return to Key West on Sunday."
Another voice, French UN Ambassador Roger Seydoux, in favor of a UN seat for Red China.
"It is the government of Peking which, after bringing about and maintaining the unity of the country, is the only entity able to speak and act in its behalf."
The battle over price increases between the aluminum industry and the government ended with an announcement from Alcoa.
"Aluminum Company of America announced tonight that it is rescinding the price restorations it made last Monday. Alcoa emphasized that it continues to feel strongly that its pricing actions were non-inflationary and were justified by economic circumstances."
A pointed question about the aluminum battle, a question for Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, asked by ABC's Bill Downs.
"Mr. Secretary, is it true or isn't it? You did put pressure on the aluminum industry to make them stop the price rise."
I think we do an injustice to these executives when we say that they would act only when clubbed.
A postscript to the aluminum price battle from Senator Everett Dirksen.
"Evidently, industry, from their own figures, determined that they were going to have to put up the price. And in my book, arithmetic is still the greatest of the sciences."
Another kind of arithmetic. Canadian Prime Minister Lester Pearson's Liberal Party won more seats than other parties in Canada's parliamentary election, but not a majority in Parliament, leaving a big question of whether Pearson can stay in power. Pearson commented on the returns.
"I think the continuation of a minority government in the House of Commons presents problems both for Parliament and for the country."
Pearson's opponent, Conservative John Diefenbaker, was cryptic.
"This has been a very interesting election. The Prime Minister called it in order to get a majority. He said without a majority, he would be unable to carry out the government of Canada. He has received his answer."
The national debate over Vietnam continued this week with anti-Vietnam policy demonstrations in some areas and a lot of talk about draft card burning. Senator Dirksen was one of those who had something to say.
"I'd hate to be a draft card burner. I think the time would come when I couldn't live with my own soul and my own conscience."
22-year-old Roger LaPorte apparently followed his conscience this week and set fire to himself in front of the UN to protest the war in Vietnam. A New York policeman tried to help.
When we got to the scene, we observed this man lying in the roadway in flames. And my partner jumped out with a fire extinguisher from the car. The UN guards were there with their fire extinguisher. We tried to extinguish the flames as best we could.
LaPorte died of his self-inflicted burns one day after he set fire to himself to show that he was against war, all war. And as the Vietnam War went on, the casualty lists grew longer, amid reports that even more Americans will be sent to fight the communists in Vietnam, with 200,000 expected to be there by the first of the year. Of those Americans and the war, Senator Dirksen.
Perchance the end is not yet, because you will find high military advisors who frankly and firmly believe that it will take more muscle, it will take more manpower before we solve that problem, and it will take time also in order to do it. Who shall say how many additional young Americans may have to be called to the colors?
Americans who gave their lives in defending the colors were honored this week. Marine Corps Commandant General Wallace Green spoke on the 190th anniversary of the Marines.
Let us again remember our comrades, those who gave all in yesterday's battles, and who made this heritage possible. Let us faithfully sustain those engaged in today's struggle in Southeast Asia.
And on Veterans Day at Arlington National Cemetery, our ABC microphones were there as Vice President Hubert Humphrey spoke of Vietnam.
We are there because once again in history, it must be proved to the aggressors that the price of their aggression comes far too high.
The Vice President spoke of his country's honor.
We have fulfilled the responsibility of leadership. We have not wavered. We have not turned inward. We have not withdrawn from the world. And we will not.
So went this world this week. And the voices in the headlines.
Voices in the Headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News. Written and produced by H. Paul Jeffers. Directed by Dennis J. Dennehy. Executive producer Tom O'Brien. Production staff Gene Carlson, Len Hirschfield, and Cy Kantrowitz. Special effects by Bob Ring. Your narrator, Fred Foy. This is Les Griffiths inviting you to keep up with the news every hour of every day on this ABC radio station, and to catch up with the news each week on Voices in the Headlines.